Well, maybe it's ungracious, but I have to add one qualification to what Amy just said. I do sometimes get mentioned in the New York Times. In fact, just a couple of days ago, there was an op-ed which was one of the standard tantrums about how awful the 1960s were, and they were pretty awful. They really civilized the country. That's pretty dangerous. But I was mentioned as one of the last stale holdovers, still peddling that 1960s line that governments and corporations play some role in global planning. You know, real heresy. It's not the exact words that were used, but that's what they meant. So if you don't mind some stale holdovers, I'll go on with that heresy today. There's lots of articles in the press and the journals, the foreign policy journals, these last couple of weeks, trying to evaluate the first year of President Obama's foreign policy, what was achieved, what the problems are, and so on. One of the longest and most detailed ones was in the journal National Interest by Richard Burt, a well-known policy analyst. And among other things, he compared Obama with George Bush, number one, the first Bush. The first Bush was criticized because he lacked what was called the vision thing. Obama, on the other hand, but Burt said, you know, he, in practice, he very successful, but lacked vision. Obama, he suggests, is sort of the opposite. Grand vision, real vision of what should be done, but he hasn't succeeded much in practice. And in fact, both Bush and Obama have accepted that designation, not doing well, but George Bush the first agreed. He said, yeah, he said, I'm not into vision. He's into doing things. And Obama, when he was, came under some criticism when he appointed his economic advisors, because they were all drawn from people who'd helped engineer the financial crisis that was consuming the economy. He said, yes, it's true, I'm getting experts in the economy, but you don't have to worry because I'll provide the vision. Okay, well, we can see where that led. On the foreign policy, let's then keep to the vision, the admirable part. My favorite newspaper, the London Financial Times, a couple of days ago, identified Obama's major foreign policy problem today as Iran. The occasion for the article was Hillary Clinton's failure to convince Brazil to go along with the United States on calling for harsher sanctions, and President Lula's insistence that there should be engagement with Iran, commercial relations, and so on, and that it has a right to enrich uranium for producing nuclear energy, as do all signers of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Well, it was reported here too, of course, and Lula's position was considered sort of paradoxical. Why is he not going along with the international community, with the world? That's an interesting usage, which is a very striking reflection of the depth of the culture of imperialism. Who is the international community? Well, it turns out, if you look, that the international community is Washington and whoever happens to agree with it at the moment. The rest are not part of the world. They're kind of in opposition. Well, in this case, Lula's position happens to be that of most of the world. You can think it's right or wrong or whatever, but just as a matter of fact, for example, it's the position of the former non-aligned countries, the majority of countries of the world, the large majority of their populations, they have repeatedly and vigorously supported Iran's right to enrich uranium for peaceful purposes, reiterating that it's a signer of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which does grant that right. So they're not part of the world. Another group that's not part of the world is the population of the United States. The last polls that I've seen a couple of years ago, in those polls, a considerable majority of Americans agreed that Iran has a right to develop nuclear energy, but of course not nuclear weapons. And in fact, as the poll demonstrated, the opinions of Americans on this issue were almost identical with opinions of Iranians on a whole range of issues. And in fact, when the poll was presented in Washington at a press conference, the presenter pointed out that if people were able to make policy, could be that these tensions and conflicts would be resolved. Well, that was a few years ago. Since then, there's been a huge mass of propaganda about the threat of Iran and so on. And it's very likely, I would guess, that if the poll were taken today, those figures for the American population would be different. But that was 2007, 3 years ago. So at that point, Americans were not part of the world. Most of the majority of people of the world were not part of the world. And Lula, by repeating their view, is also not part of the world. Could be added that he's almost surely the most popular political figure in the world, but that doesn't mean anything either. So what about the conflict with Iran and the threat of Iran? Nobody in their right mind wants Iran to develop nuclear weapons, or anyone for that matter. So on that, there's complete agreement. And in fact, there are significant problems about a proliferation of nuclear weapons. It's not a joke. And Obama's vision forcibly includes, stresses the need to stop the proliferation of nuclear weapons and to reduce or maybe remove nuclear weapons. Well, that's the vision. What's the practice? Well, the practice became clear a couple of months ago. Once again, the Security Council passed a resolution, 1887, I think it was October, calling on, with a criticism of Iran for not living up to commitments that that were demanded by the Security Council, and also calling on all states to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty and to solve all their conflicts within the framework of the Non-Proliferation Treaty without any threats of force. Well, that particular part of the resolution was not exactly headlined here for a simple reason. It was directed at two countries, the two countries that are regularly threatening the use of force. The United States and Israel. The threat of force is in violation of the UN Charter, if anybody cares about that stale old stuff, even older than the 60s. But that's never mentioned. But just across the spectrum here, almost everyone insists that the usual phrase is, we must keep all options open. That's a threat of force. And the threat of force is not just idle. So, for example, Israel is sending its nuclear submarines into the Gulf, firing distance. They're undetectable, basically, into areas where they could fire nuclear missiles. Of course, Israel has plenty of nuclear weapons. Fire them at Iran. The U.S. and others are... Its allies are carrying out field operations, you know, the exercises plainly aimed at Iran. There's a little hitch because Turkey is refusing to go along, but that's what they've been trying to do. So they're regular threats, verbal and in policy. Israel actually is sending the nuclear submarines and other warships through the Suez Canal with the tacit agreement of Egypt, the Egyptian dictatorship, another U.S. client in the region. Well, those are all threats, constant, verbal, actual. And the threats do have the effect of inducing Iran to develop a deterrent. Whether they're doing it or not, I don't know. Maybe they are. But if they are, the reason, as I think almost all serious analysts would agree, is not because they intend to use nuclear weapons or missiles with nuclear weapons. If they even loaded a missile with nuclear weapons, assuming they had them, the country would be vaporized in 5 minutes. And nobody believes that the ruling clerics, whatever one thinks about them, have a kind of a death wish and want to see the entire country and society and everything they own destroyed. In fact, U.S. intelligence figures are pretty high, and you who've talked about it estimate the possibility of Iran ever actually using a nuclear weapon as maybe 1%, you know, so low that you can't estimate it. But it's possible that they might develop them as a deterrent. One of Israel's leading military historians, Martin von Krefeld, a couple of years ago, after the invasion of Iraq, wrote in the international press that, of course, he doesn't want to see Iran have nuclear weapons. He said, but if they're not developing them, they're crazy. The U.S. had just invaded Iraq, knowing that it was totally defenseless. It was part of the reason why they felt free to invade. Everybody can understand that. The Iranian leaders can certainly understand it. So therefore, to quote von Krefeld again, if they're not developing a nuclear deterrent, they're crazy. Well, whether they are or not is another question, but there's no doubt that the hostile and aggressive stance taken by the United States and its Israeli client are a factor in whatever planning is going on in top Iranian circles as to whether to develop a nuclear deterrent or not. And Lula, I think, has a point when he says, along with the actual world, not what's technically called the world, in suggesting that interaction, commercial and other, is the a proper way to try to constrain whatever the threat may be. And I think the UN Security Council was correct in concluding that, back last October, that the threat of force should be abandoned, and that issues involving interstate conflict should be resolved within the framework of the UN Charter and the Non-Proliferation Treaty in this case, again, aimed at the United States and Israel. Well, the Security Council resolution, there were reactions to the Security Council resolution. In part, there were reactions on the part of the three states. There are three states which have never signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty, so they're the worst violators by far. The three states are India, Pakistan, and Israel. Those are the three states that have never signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. They've all developed nuclear weapons with the assistance of the United States. In the case of Pakistan, it was primarily under Reagan, the Reagan administration, which very strongly supported the worst of the Pakistani dictators, and there have been a lot of bad ones. The worst by far was Zia-ul Haq, who was developing nuclear weapons, and of course the Reagan administration knew about it, but pretended they didn't know so they could still keep providing aid to their favorite dictator, who at the same time was carrying out radical Islamization of Pakistan, you know, with Saudi Arabian funding. Saudi Arabia and Pakistan are the two leading sources of radical Islamic fundamentalism, including jihadi terrorism, Saudi Arabia primarily, both close allies of the United States and Britain. Both the United States and Britain have been supporting them throughout this whole period. In the 1980s, that's when you got the spread of madrasas, you know, extremist religious schools all over Pakistan, funded by Saudi Arabia, backed by the United States. That was supposed to have to do with Pakistan's support for opposing the Russian invasion of Afghanistan. And the U.S. and Saudi Arabia and Pakistan did, in fact, try to organize the most extreme radical Islamic fundamentalists they could find anywhere, and send them to Afghanistan to fight there. Now, the goal of that was not to liberate Afghanistan. That would have been a legitimate goal, to fight the Russians, but that wasn't the goal. The CIA chief in Islamabad made the goal explicit. He said, we're doing this in order to kill Russians. It's not going to liberate Afghanistan. In fact, this wasn't a concern. It probably dragged out the war, but they were able to kill Russians, and that's good. So that's, meanwhile, Pakistan developed nuclear weapons. It got, there was a strong, it's not a majority by any means, but there's a strong radical Islamist jihadi tendency that developed in Pakistan, and that's part of what we're facing, what the world is facing today. So that's Pakistan. What about India? Well, India, their nuclear weapons program got a big shot in the arm from the second George Bush. A couple of years ago, George Bush signed a treaty with India, which overcame U.S. law. India had been developing nuclear weapons in violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and Congress had passed sanctions conditions back in the 1970s. Bush essentially overrode those and also overrode international resolutions to permit India to have access to nuclear technology, theoretically for civilian use, but everyone knows that if you provide technology for civilian use, it just means that it can be diverted to weapons production, and in effect it frees India to develop nuclear weapons. U.S. pressure succeeded in ramming that through the nuclear suppliers group. They had no way of stopping the United States, so they went along. But that tears a big hole in the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And in fact, India reacted to the Security Council resolution last fall right away by announcing that it now has the capacity to produce nuclear weapons of the same yield as the superpowers, the United States and Russia. Well, that was their reaction, thanks to, in part, to our support. The Obama administration immediately informed India that the resolution didn't apply to them, so they didn't have to worry about the Security Council resolution that calls on states to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty and to accept its regime. Well, that's India. Pakistan wasn't even mentioned. Yes, and in fact, the more India increases its nuclear weapons capacity, the more Pakistan does, with a very serious threat of nuclear war. It's come quite close a couple of times, and the threat is still there and growing. So that's India and Pakistan. Well, the Obama administration, at the same time as the Security Council resolution, roughly the same time, the International Atomic Energy Agency passed a resolution calling on Israel to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty and to open up its nuclear facilities to inspection. As far as I'm aware, that was never reported in the United States. In fact, I learned about it because I happened to be in Mexico, and I was reading the Mexican press, which published wire service reports. I didn't know whether to believe them or not, so I came back and checked, and yeah, it was accurate. It was in the military journals and so on. The only reference I could find to it in the English press was in the Irish Times. They happened to report it. But it happened. I mean, there was an interesting resolution. The United States and Europe had tried to block the resolution, but they weren't able to block it. And then it passed with a majority of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Well, Obama did react, same way as to India. The administration informed Israel that they didn't have to pay any attention to this, didn't apply to them. Now that's reiterating a informal but well-known agreement between President Nixon and Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir back in the Nixon years, saying that the U.S. agreed that Israeli development of nuclear weapons is kind of off the agenda. We don't allow any discussion of this. So that's the reaction of the three powers that never joined the Non-Proliferation Treaty, in all cases with U.S. support. Well, that has something to do with non-proliferation. Actually, the General Assembly also passed a resolution calling on Israel to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty and open up its facilities. There were the U.S. and Israel, of course, voted against it, and they were able to pick up two more votes. So there were four votes against the resolution in the General Assembly, which is a little more than usual. Sometimes can't even get them. So, for example, a year earlier, the General Assembly passed an important resolution trying to regulate the arms trade, what's called small arms, but small doesn't mean very small. That means less than nuclear weapons. Those are the ones that are carrying out massacres and slaughters all over the world. And that, the U.S. voted against it, not alone that time. It was joined by Zimbabwe. That was a little embarrassing, so I don't think it ever got reported. But that's the kind of thing that happens pretty regularly, if you look. Okay, that's... Obama also reacted, not directly, but to the Security Council resolution. At the time that he got his Nobel Prize, the Pentagon, for, you know, bringing about peace and so on, and opposing nuclear weapons, at about within days, the Pentagon announced that it is has been accelerating development of massive ordnance penetrators, I think is the technical word. These are huge bombs, the biggest ones in the U.S. arsenal, 13-ton bombs or something like that, which are designed so that they can penetrate deep, not only deep into the ground, but right through many, many layers of reinforced concrete. The proposal was initiated under the Bush administration, but it kind of languished. However, as soon as Obama came in, he accelerated the development of these weapons, and according to the Pentagon, they're going to be put into place, maybe they're already there, a couple of months from the time of the announcement, a couple of years before the original plan. Everybody knows what they're for. There's only one target for those. That's another threat against Iran. Okay, that was Obama's reaction to the resolution. Well, you know, there's more to say about this. I mean, as I mentioned, certainly nobody wants Iran to develop nuclear weapons, and we should undertake sensible measures to try to prevent that. There's one measure which would could be quite significant. It doesn't give 100% security, but it could advance these efforts. And that is to establish a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East. Again, verification is never 100% reliable, but it can be carried out. And there would be ways to reduce the tensions, maybe mitigate the tensions, and maybe eliminate them, if there were a nuclear weapons-free zone. Well, there's overwhelming support for this. In the American population, a huge majority. Iran, huge majority. The countries are officially committed to it. You know, official doesn't mean anything unless the population does something. Actually, the United States and Britain have a special commitment to this, very uniquely, a deep commitment to this. The reason is that when they invaded Iraq, they tried to provide a kind of a thin legal cover for the invasion. And the legal cover referred to a Security Council resolution in 1991, Resolution 687, 1991, the Security Council called on Iraq to eliminate its weapons of mass destruction. And as you recall, the US and Britain claimed that they were developing weapons of mass destruction, so that was the legal argument for invading Iraq. Nobody outside of the White House and 10 Downing Street took it very seriously, but anyway, that was the legal argument. Well, if you read that resolution, you get down as far as Article 14, you can find it on the internet, you see that that resolution calls on the signers to move to establish a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East. Well, that means that the U.S. and Britain have a very special commitment to this, over and above everyone else, over and above the fact that the world's in favor of it, the American population, and so on. And that could be a step towards strengthening the Non-Proliferation Treaty and reducing the threat of nuclear weapons. But the vision doesn't go that far. The vision only goes as far as some pleasant rhetoric. And the steps that could be taken to implement it are off the agenda, can't be discussed. I don't know if anyone's ever discussed this anywhere near the mainstream. But the facts are pretty straightforward. You can check them. And it goes beyond that. There are other nuclear weapons-free zones growing throughout the world. And, you know, they're not the answer to everything, but they're a step towards reducing the threat of nuclear weapons. Just a couple of months ago, Africa, the African states agreed, after long debate and discussion, to establish an African nuclear weapons-free zone. There's only one hitch. The U.S. won't go along. The U.S. and Britain are blocking it. The reason is that the reason has to do with an island, Diego Garcia, which the African Union regards as part of Africa, but it's an island that was a British colony, and at the orders of the master, Britain expelled the population from Diego Garcia so that the United States could build a huge military base there, which it has, and that's not just for fun. I mean, that's the military base from which the U.S. carries out its, and Britain carry out their bombing operations in the Middle East and Central Asia. It's one of the main bases. And that base stores nuclear weapons. In fact, just last December, the Navy announced that it's sending a submarine tender to Diego Garcia to take care of the nuclear submarines that are there and the nuclear weapons. None of this ever gets reported, but it's there. Oh. Okay. I'm supposed to stop rehashing all this 1960s stuff. So I'll stop in a minute. Let me just finish this part of it. There's a lot more to say about Obama's foreign policy, but you can bring it up. A nuclear weapons-free zone in Africa would make good sense. It would mean closing down Diego Garcia, maybe even allowing the population to return to what's left of the island. But that one's not working because of U.S.-British rejection. There's another one in the South Pacific. It's a nuclear weapons-free zone there. That one was held up for a long time by France because France wanted to use its islands for nuclear weapons tests. But finally, France exploded its nuclear weapons, and they're not holding it up anymore. So it's being held up by the usual one vote. The United States won't permit it because the U.S. has islands there, which are very useful. Sometimes they even vote with the U.S. at the U.N., so it isn't 100% against one. We can sometimes get Palau and Micronesia. But the main significance of them is that the U.S. uses them to store nuclear weapons. And nuclear submarines and so on pass through. So therefore, the U.S. refuses to allow them to be included in the South Pacific nuclear weapons-free zone. But overcoming that would be a considerable step towards reducing nuclear proliferation and also the threat constant threat and often actual practice of using these facilities because they're used all the time. That's Iran. The vision extends much farther. Israel, Palestine, Latin America, other things. There's a great deal to say about them. Thanks to the instructions, I'll stop at this point and save you from these stale 1960s residues.